Thank you, and I'd like to now introduce a member of our planning team, Brian Volk, who will introduce our speaker of the morning.
Good morning. The cliche for an introduction would be to stand up here and to say that it's a pleasure and a privilege to introduce Beth Newman, and that of course is true, but the reality is that it's a delight and a mystery to introduce Beth Newman. The cliche would be to go over her many accomplishments, that she teaches at Baptist Theological Seminary in Richmond. She's the author of a wonderful book out on the Brazos table, part of the Christian Practices of Everyday Life series from the Ecclesia Project, entitled Untamed Hospitality, Welcoming God and Other Strangers, that she's a participant in the Baptist World Alliance Conversations with the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, which, as a wretched papist, interests me. That she's working on a book on Teresa of Avila. And that she's married to a Methodist, which I leave up to you to decide who is the social climber in that relationship. That would be the cliche. But the reality is that my particular delight in introducing Beth is that she's an introvert. And she's not an introvert like those who cover up their introversion with lots of talk and interaction at great cost to themselves. I know those kind of people. I'm one of them. But Beth is the sort of introvert who is a mystery and leads you in, entices you to listen, encourages you to hear. And I have found consistently that what I hear is well worth attending to. So it is my delight and a mystery to introduce Beth Newman.
Okay, Brian, thank you. Need to turn this on. Thank you so much for that introduction. And it's really a delight for me to be here with you, so many of you who I've known across the years, and to think together about how to be church. I always leave these meetings greatly inspired, so it's certainly a privilege. I have a handout that I hope you have in front of you, and I wanted to begin by reading this poem by George Herbert, a 17th century divine, and the title of the poem is Love 3. Some of you might be familiar with this. But I want to read it because it's a failed attempt to decline an offer of hospitality. A failed attempt to decline an offer of hospitality. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. Aghast, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, the ungrateful, ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. And so I did sit and eat. There are three aspects of this poem that I'd like to emphasize as we consider how to orient or reorient our lives around hospitality. The first is that God's welcome to us is always prior to our welcome to others. The second is the ways in which our sense of unworthiness flows from what is, in fact, a kind of narcissism. And the third is how a release from the self-obsession frees us to see the other as a guest worthy to be here. So first, vulnerability, the heart of Christian hospitality. In his treatise on the Incarnation, Athanasius reflects on the strange mystery of the God of the whole universe becoming a mere human. He asks, why did God not manifest himself by means of other and nobler parts of creation and use some nobler instruments, such as sun or moon or stars or fire or air, instead of mere man? In our modern culture of disbelief, such a question might be phrased, why doesn't God end our suffering or stop war or manifest himself in some powerful way that all can see? Athanasius responds, the Lord did not come to make a display. He came to put himself at the disposal of those who needed him and to be manifested according as they could bear it, not impairing the value of the divine appearing by exceeding their capacity to receive him. Athanasius' response then to why God came as mere human is that God comes to us in a way that humans can receive God. That is, God comes as one of us. God becomes vulnerable to us. As we read in the well-known passage from Philippians, Christ Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. And being found in human form, he humbled himself. Such vulnerability lies at the heart of Christian hospitality. Many assume the first step in hospitality is to give. Christian hospitality, however, is first about learning to receive. In Christ, we learn how to need what God desires to give us. We need God's love, we need God's wisdom, we need one another. To discover such needs is to become vulnerable because we realize we are not self-made men or women. We are not individuals trying to survive or trying to chart our own careers. We do not have to outsmart the other guy or compete to get to the front of the line. We do not have to be the best athlete, the smartest student, or to raise our children to win, win, win. But self-accomplishment, as a yardstick for self-worth, is instilled in many of us from an early age. How do we measure up? Even as I was preparing this talk, that question haunted me. Colleagues from graduate school, and even worse, a former wonderful professor might be in this room. How will I measure up? This is often the shape of what we bring to the table when we think about hospitality. What kind of impression am I making? What can I or the church do to extend hospitality to others? What are we able to put on the table? A food pantry? A better Sunday school curriculum? A better pastor? Or in higher education, better facilities, online courses, more degrees? Such questions turn on how attractive we make ourselves in the eyes of others. Some of these results might be good, a food pantry, for example. But when it comes to hospitality, this approach misses the heart of the matter. These are all examples of people deciding to do things for others according to what they think is best. To say the heart of hospitality is vulnerability means it begins with a particular kind of receiving, an acknowledgement that before we give anything at all, we must first receive. And for Christians, of course, this means that we have no idea what to give apart from what we receive together as the body of Christ. Such receiving and the giving that flows from it is not an occasional event, but a way of being. Hans Reinders, in an essay on parenting the mentally disabled, contrast the difference between doing for and being with. Doing for, he says, refers to those who want to do something for the disabled, the professional or the teacher, and, you know, they can do good things. But being with refers to the notion of wanting to share your life with somebody. It is the distinction, he says, between personal intervention and personal presence. From this perspective, the greater challenge then is learning how to receive rather than rushing in to give. Such reception rests on learning to see the other as a gift. The important thing to know, says Reinders, is not how to love and to be good, but how to be loved, despite our faults and failures. The most important thing is not to strive towards your own perfection, but to learn to live with your imperfections. Learning to live with your imperfections can easily sound like an excuse to avoid practicing hospitality altogether. Yet, as Reinders concludes, living with their imperfection is what mentally disabled people have been doing all their lives. This is how they become healers. Unquote. This might sound counterintuitive. How can those who live with such imperfections become healers? But by having to live without illusions, those with mental handicaps witness to the fact that God calls us not to be perfect, at least as society defines this. Rather, God calls us to lives of faithfulness in communion with each other. Faithfulness, rather than perfection, enables us to live lives of vulnerability, and so to see our own weaknesses, as well as those of others, not as limitations, but as places of deep grace. As Paul tells the Corinthians in a familiar passage, "The Lord's grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." I was fortunate years ago to meet Jean Vanier when he came to the University of Notre Dame to receive the Lotari Medal. Vanier, as many of you know, is the founder of L'Arche Communities, homes where folks with and without mental handicaps live together. Unfortunately for me at the time, it was a dark period in my own life because I had been diagnosed with a mental illness, which I found at the time absolutely devastating because it shattered my image of myself as together, right? I wrote a note to Vanier during his lecture, which I handed him afterwards. He took it with such love on his face and later wrote me several beautiful notes. In retrospect, I can see that the kind of welcome that flowed so easily from Vanier to me, a complete stranger, comes from his whole way of being so vulnerable to Christ in the presence of those with whom he lives. A challenge to us is that Vanier can seem so exceptional. Like others, Mother Teresa, for example, such practitioners of hospitality are amazing people, the saints of the church. How do the rest of us ordinary folk practice a hospitality of vulnerability, both in and outside of the church? So, worship as vulnerable hospitality. The first place we can turn is to name what we are already doing as a hospitality of vulnerability, namely our worship of the triune God. Worship names the place where God is vulnerable to us. This might sound strange to some. How can we reconcile God's vulnerability with God's power and God's transcendence? As Karl Barth reminds us, and as I also learned from Stanley, God is mysterious not in God's remoteness, but in God's nearness in Jesus Christ. And in Jesus, God exposes himself to us, to our apathy, our lies, our self-deceptions, our rejection. The Japanese author Shisaku Endo captures this divine vulnerability at the end of his historical novel, Silence. Some of you might be familiar with it. The setting is one where Japanese Christians are being forced to reject Christ in order to save their lives. The sign of their rejection is to stomp on an image of Christ. Okay? So, you know, to violate the very thing they stand for. When the main character, a priest, can no longer endure the torture, he hears the image of Christ say, quote, "Trample," said those compassionate eyes. "Your foot suffers in pain. I understand your pain and your suffering. It is for this reason that I am here," unquote. Christ telling us to reject him might seem problematic. But the deeper point here is that Christ makes himself so vulnerable to us that he is willing to accept rejection and even death. In worship, then, we learn the truth of what it means to be guests, hosts, strangers, and even enemies as we participate in divine hospitality, extended most fully through word and sacrament. In our rejection of Christ, in our sinful refusal of Christ, we learn to name how we are enemies of God. As guests, we learn to receive God's forgiveness and God's vision of ourselves as his people. As hosts, we become part of Christ's body, offering our gifts for the church and the world. In worship, we participate in God's vulnerable hospitality then, through this particular gathering, through the table, and through the word. But we often bring to worship certain walls, perhaps invisible to us, that have been erected by assumptions from outside the gospel story. As I think Danny nicely described yesterday, and which continue to deform who and where we are. I'll contrast here the shot glass used during communion in my Baptist heritage. If you haven't seen these, they really are like little shot glasses that we use for the grape juice. The common cup is certainly a more powerful image of the oneness of the body. The individual thimble of grape juice underwrites the private communion with Jesus. And I find it interesting that hygiene is the reason most often cited for personal cups. Eating and drinking with others is risky business, as so many passengers on cruise lines can testify. Such walls, though, can keep us confined in a distorted world. The animal trainer, Vicki Hearn, in her book Adam's Task, tells a wonderful story about a horse named Hala, who everyone thought was crazy. And so she was treated, and she's just written off as a crazy horse. Until one day, along came a very gifted trainer, a man by the name of Winkler, who had a different story about the kind of horse Hala was. She wasn't crazy at all, Winkler maintained. Rather, Hala was a high-strung and extremely gifted horse. Under Winkler's supervision, Hala became the brilliant horse that she was. In reflecting on this story, Hearn writes that this great trainer, Winkler, had to have had a story, quote, about how what appears to be horse insanity may be, even must be, most of the time, evidence of how powerful equine genius is and how powerfully it can object to incoherence. And he must have had a story like that about Hala, which would move him to keep thinking and trying when things got rough. The stories we tell matter, and not only do stories reclaim the beauty of crazy horses, but also stories lead to insanity in the first place. Unquote. Winkler gave Hala then the gift of a truthful story. In Herbert's, our poet's, language, she becomes a loved and delightful guest, worthy to be here. By analogy, we are like Hala in that we have a more beautiful story to tell ourselves about who we are and who God desires us to be. Hala's story suggests that we do not have to live out of old habits of being that often loudly shout, "Protect yourself, be anxious, do more so that you will be admired and loved." We could add others. Whatever these voices are saying, the Spirit gives the church a different tongue, one that speaks of a vulnerable God who heals our wounds through his. rightly understood, then worship breaks open our lives so that we might become God's vulnerable hospitality for the world, and so that the beauty of our life together as church might be seen. Worship enables us to see, as the Princeton Proposal for Christian Unity states, that God's grace, in this present history at least, is made visible only in human weakness. The most serious concern about worship as vulnerable hospitality, in my view, has to do with the brokenness of the church. If we cannot fully share at the Lord's table with one another, if our home is divided, then is our hospitality not compromised? Such division easily causes us to see other Christians around the world as strangers. We see them, first of all, as Mexicans, Iraqis, foreigners, fundamentalists, immigrants, and so forth. Because we are separated, it becomes more difficult to be in places of vulnerability with one another. It is far easier for denominations or different communions to compete and even to justify themselves rather than to practice a vulnerable hospitality. An example of this in my own tradition is this search over the past few 20 years or so for Baptist distinctives as a way to shore up and secure Baptist identity over against others, especially Catholics. A hospitality of vulnerability, however, begins by considering how we need one another even more. To come from a place of vulnerability allows others to show us our needs. It is in this spirit that Gerhard Lofink interprets the marriage feast parable in Luke's gospel. So I'll just, this is Luke 14, I'll just read the last part of this. But when you're invited to a marriage feast, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, "Friend, go up to a higher place." Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit with you at the table. Lofink notes that some have been offended by this parable because it seems to suggest a sham humility. The guest selects the worst place only in order to receive the higher one. But Lofink offers this interpretation. Quote, "In God's new society, people no longer have to worry about the place that is rightfully theirs. They can let other people show them the place that is right for them. What looks like a comic rule of propriety is really the reversal of all bourgeois values. No one need any longer struggle unceasingly for his or her own reputation, but instead all can be concerned about God's reputation and allow their own honor to be received as gift." Stated in terms of vulnerable hospitality, we are free to allow others to show us our needs as well as our gifts. Of course, the challenge is that we really do not think we need these others. As I've already suggested, most Baptists seldom believe they really need Catholics, and probably vice versa. We likely do not think we need our neighbor next door, except in cases of an emergency. We probably do not believe we really need our Mexican neighbors or our Iraqi neighbors. What would need even look like in these scenarios, since they're so far away from a lot of us? Gerard Schlabach reminds us that the Eucharist, quote, "teaches Christians to recognize these divisions precisely as a scandal." As we read in 1 Corinthians 12, "For in one spirit we are all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free. We are all made to drink of one spirit." The primacy of other dwellings, whether our private home, our social class, our country, or ecclesial division, will inevitably compromise our practice, which means then that we are involved in an ongoing struggle, one ultimately that is not simply a flesh and blood. A biblical story that powerfully captures this wounded, struggling hospitality is Jacob, familiar one, wrestling with an angel on the banks of the Jabbok. He is struggling with God. He wants a blessing. He wants to know God's name. Such a strange story. As we know, in such a strange story, Jacob walks away content, though wounded and limping. But he knows who he is. He knows he's blessed by God. He knows his name, Israel. In worship, the whole church, like Jacob Israel, wrestles with God in order to know her true identity. And in this, we are together in our brokenness as we come before the broken body and blood of Christ in order to be made whole. Next section, vulnerable hospitality as friendship with Christ, the church, and neighbors far. A vulnerable hospitality shaped by Christian worship is a way of life. But how do we know we are not simply projecting our desires and half-truths, a word I learned from the Grace community when I visited, half-truth, onto others? How do we know that we are not dwelling in a kind of house of mirrors like the ones at our local fairs? The classical myth of Narcissus, you will recall, is about a beautiful young man doomed by the gods to gaze at his own reflection for having, which is the part that I knew, I forgot the second part. He's doomed that way because he has rejected the love of the nymph Echo. The gods don't like the fact that he's not propagating, right? The myth is typically told today as a warning against egoism. But there's another way to interpret this myth. Since Narcissus can only look at his own reflection, he is unable to give and receive love. He is unable to be vulnerable. On this view, Narcissus is not so much an egotistical person as a tragic one, trapped in his own illusion. As David Kettle states in his recent book, Western Culture and Gospel Context, Narcissus may seem at first sight to be too full of himself, to the exclusion of all others. But the deeper story is of a personal lack and a futile longing. In Augustinian terms, his heart remains profoundly restless. Kettle argues, in fact, influenced by Christopher Lash, that we live in a narcissistic society, at least in our dominant culture. He means by this that dominant themes constantly circle around and foster self-absorption that arises from and perpetuates a sense of lack, a sense of unworthiness, not looking good enough, not successful enough, not happy enough, not good enough, and on and on. You're familiar, I'm sure, with this. We are trapped in our own obsessions as Narcissus was trapped in his face. All this to say that our brokenness is a tricky thing when it comes to hospitality. Are we simply reflecting our own false image and distorted desires onto others? Are we able to see the others as she is in contrast to who we have already expected her to be? Are we fearful of the other, afraid they will disturb our fragile, distorted images? What is the remedy that will truly enable to walk out of this sort of image of the house of mirrors into a different kind of space? Teresa of Avila tells of a crucial moment in her life at age 39 when she stood before a statue of Christ in Gethsemane. The suffering Christ touched her in a way that she had not experienced before. In this vision, she sensed that Christ needed her, even if only to wipe the sweat from his brow. But she also felt inadequate to do this. As she narrates it, she realizes that Christ wants her friendship and desires her company. And it's something that she realizes in a way that she hasn't ever before. So it transforms her. In some ways, this is a simple truth. You know, Christ loves her. But the vision of the vulnerable Christ enables her to see and live more deeply into the truth of who she is before God. Teresa was lucky, we might think, you know, to have this dramatic vision. The interesting point of Teresa's story, however, is that her vision enables her to see and claim a truth available to all of us. Christ wants our company and wants us to be in his company. We are no longer a house of mirrors seeing only our own reflection, or the distorted reflection of others. We are rather in a dwelling that invites us to see others through Christ, and, absolutely crucial, to see ourselves through Christ. Teresa's initial response is typical. I'm not worthy of your company. I don't really have much to offer. This hardly seems narcissistic. But Teresa is caught in her own image of herself. She has become her own judge. But Christ, as Bart familiarly puts it, is the judge, judged in our place. We are thus freed from having to look in a mirror of our own making and can instead allow ourselves to be judged by Christ. And his judgment is that he wants our friendship. This can easily sound overly casual, as if Jesus is simply a good buddy or a private friend. But to be in the company of Jesus through the Spirit is to be in the company of all the saints. Holy, 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 all the saints adore thee, casting down their golden crowns around the glassy sea. This is no house of mirrors, but rather a people and a glassy sea that reflects the triune holiness of God. Recently, I read a number of testimonies of immigration in sort of preparation for this event in a book titled Trails of Hope and Terror. In one of these stories, a young woman tells of being part of a team leaving food and water in the desert for Mexicans trying to make it across the borders illegally. These crossings are dangerous, as I'm sure some of you know better than I do, because the folks are unable to carry a sufficient supply of water. They often have to travel in the dark. They often fall, injure themselves. Some are left behind, and some die. And they were all terribly afraid. On one occasion, this woman and the three members of her team happened upon a large group of migrants hiding in a ravine. As was customary for the team, they called out, "Somos amigos de la iglesia." You know, we are friends of the church. This call out of ecclesial friendship was enough to enable some of the terrified folk to come out of hiding. And as they did, they slowly engaged in conversation, revealing that they too were friends of the church. They brought out pictures of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and they began saying how they had prayed to God for their safety and for the safety of their families back home. It makes all the difference in the world whether we discuss the immigration question as members and friends of Christ's church or as citizens of the United States. One can conceive of an argument over cost-benefit of allowing more people into the United States. It is impossible to conceive of a discussion of whether the church is already full. Right? To name ecclesial friendship as a boundary rather than nationality, economics, and so forth invites us then to move beyond our shriveled human imagination toward God. Nicholas Adams uses this latter phrase of moving beyond shriveled imagination toward God actually in describing the ancient creeds, which of course describe the pattern of the Christian story. At the heart of this ecclesial imagination lies the conviction that God desires our company. As Joseph Mangina puts it, pouring out his blessings upon his people Israel, God extends these riches even to the Gentiles in the creation of the ecclesia. Such a reality involves saying to one another across broken barriers, we are friends of the church. Vulnerable hospitality, then, fourth thing there, as joyful neighbors near. Dancing invites us to imagine and embody before God how our lives and the lives of others are delightful gifts. David danced out of deep joy. Such dancing is a form of prayer that draws David more fully into God's presence in the Ark of the Covenant. It is interesting in this story in 2 Samuel that Saul's daughter sees in David's dancing a threat to the status quo. As we read, she despised him in her heart. Right? She has something to lose in the new reality that David represents. Dancing reflects a joyful, vulnerable hospitality and celebration of what God is doing. And in joyful dancing, giving and receiving are fluid. The exchange is not tit for tat. As the poet Yeats famously says, how can we know the dancer from the dance? Hospitality is ultimately our participation in God's hospitality, present already in creation. Gregory of Nyssa, in his commentary on Psalm 50, writes, once there was a time when the whole rational creation formed a single dancing chorus looking upward to the one leader of this dance. And the harmony of motion that they learned from this law found its way into their dancing. While sin has made an end of the sweet sounds of this chorus, Gregory writes, that which was lost will once more be ours to enjoy, and once again, we will take part in the dancing of the divine chorus. This joy is not only a heavenly reality, of course, it is also a present one. Many of you know the hymn, The Lord of the Dance, where we sing with Christ. I danced in the morning when the world was begun. I danced in the moon, the stars, and the sun. I danced down from heaven and I danced on earth. At Bethlehem, I danced my birth. Let's skip to verse 5. They cut me down, but I leapt on high. I am the light that will never, never die. But I'll live in you and you'll live in me. I am the Lord of the dance, said he. Dance then, wherever you may be. But who really dances before the Lord? At least not in my Baptist. That was like one of the seven sins. Dancing seems to have been co-opted by MTV commercials and fraternity parties. We hardly know what it even means to dance before the Lord. At least I think most of us, some of you might. A lot of us are probably too self-conscious to dance. We think we're not coordinated enough, look stupid, and so forth. But I think we can say the same thing about dancing that Bonhoeffer says about singing. Quote, it is not you that sings. It is the church that is singing, and you, as a member of the church, may share in its song. As Bonhoeffer suggests, in singing, we join our voices to a great choir already praising God. To withhold our voices is to withhold ourselves from God. Like Ananias and Sapphira, who withhold their money. This is not so much a legalistic obligation as it is a failure to imagine how our lives are constituted by joyful movements of receiving and giving the grace of Christ to others. By stepping into the dance, which has worship at its heart, we are freed from our fears, worries, and withholdings from God and others. Such freedom makes possible a freedom to dance, a vulnerable hospitality, more fully through giving and receiving to our neighbors near and far. A concern with this image of dancing could be that it's too optimistic. After all, there's much in the world that, not to dance about. There's much tragedy and suffering, much sadness. Even in our own families, family and friends can seem out of step. They do not respond as we want them to. They reject us. Maybe they've abandoned us. It's difficult to practice hospitality with the other person or persons when the other persons or persons is not playing the part they're supposed to, dancing a different dance, a different tune, one that shuts us out and fails to engage us at all. We can easily remember times when others did not want what we had to offer. On the other hand, we can also remember times when we simply were unable to welcome another. Perhaps we did not have time, we didn't like the person, or they were a threat to us. Given all of this, the joyful image of dancing as a window into vulnerable Christian hospitality seems idealistic. The difficulty, however, is not as much ideological as it is that we do not know how to dance with other people, Christians as well as those who are not. One of my near neighbors, for example, a faithful Christian, has nonetheless been a challenging dance partner for me over the years, as I'm sure I have been for her. This is not because we do not love each other, but because, and I'll speak for myself, it's been difficult at times fully for me to see how this person is a gift to me. Right? Even as I say this, I'm aware of my own incapacity for gratitude. It's not what it needs to be. But more generally, I think the question here is, how can we be grateful when someone, when our neighbor's near, you know, rub us the wrong way, say belittling things, ignore us, and we could fill that in. It's easy to love those who love you in the way that you want them to love you. Or, as Matthew states, if you love only those who love you, what reward do you have? The problem with neighbors near in our families, our congregations, our neighborhood, the academy, is that they are near. Right? You got to deal with them. Some of them will get on our nerves. We all have stories about people in congregations or workplaces or whatever, you know, where we could easily, can you believe what she did? What she said? You know, so how do we keep the dance of hospitality going amidst these sorts of challenges? Okay, I raise that as a question. I certainly do not have any quick fixes. I think for all our neighbors, perhaps especially the most difficult, you know, we can remember the dance is not simply ours. We don't have to invent the dance out of whole cloth. God gives us the grace we need to learn to see others as God does. An example of this in my own life, sort of an exceptional one, I guess, strange as this may sound, is that I had a dream of my near neighbor, the one I mentioned. She had died. She was actually dancing. And it was evident to me in the dream that she was bathed in God's love. Calm me down. I'm sorry. Got too close to that. But anyway, it was a real gift. Okay. The dance can go on because we know our own brokenness and inability to love is not an obstacle in any ultimate sense to God's love. God's light bathes all of us, helping us to see each other truthfully as children of God, redeemed through Christ. Of course, this light may be incredibly dim at times as we remain captive to our own fears and self-justifying ways. But in a way of life that follows God's providential patterns and rhythms, we can discover a greater capacity for hospitality. A sign that this is being done well is that we will be joyful, dancing with David. And my last section here is vulnerable hospitality and a stranger. The compelling truth of Matthew 25, which is, of course, familiar, when you did it to one of the least of these, you did it to me, is that, of course, Christ himself is the stranger. The disciples thought they knew Jesus. He had become familiar to them, even if he said at times things they did not understand. I call you friends, he says in John's Gospel. And yet, this parable laid down toward the end of Matthew's Gospel is that Jesus is a stranger, one of those outside the parameters of a circle already unknowingly drawn. Is it possible for Jesus, it is possible for Jesus to be needy, a prisoner, hungry, naked, and so forth, because he is no stranger to our humanity in its vulnerability, its weakness, its poverty. He is where we are in our deepest darkness. Because of this, to cite Bonhoeffer once again, where he is, there we are too. Okay, so Bonhoeffer's flipping it, right? Where he is, there we are too, in the incarnation, on the cross, and in his resurrection. What does this really mean? After all, no one today was present at the birth or death of Christ. We were not there at the resurrection. But Bonhoeffer is pointing to a broader reality. Incarnation, cross, and resurrection are the providential way we are in Christ as Christ's body in the world. As the hymn writer Brian Wren writes, Christ is alive, no longer bound to distant years in Palestine. He comes to claim the here and now and dwell in every place and time, in every insult, rift, and war where color scorn or wealth divide. He suffers still, yet loves the more, and lives, though ever crucified. Ever crucified. Hebrews, of course, states that Christ's sacrifice was once for all. So what does it mean to say he's ever crucified? But it is precisely because Christ has defeated death and sin and has been raised from the dead that he is able to be with us. Christ is alive, yet still suffering where humanity suffers, where the stranger is in need, desperately seeking a way to support his family, or where the so-called alien has left his homeland, fleeing the threat of war. We thus see the stranger not simply in a horizontal time-space frame. Einstein has shown us, apparently, take this on faith, that that clocks tick more slowly the closer they are to a gravitational mass like the sun. Okay, so this was news to me, but anyway, so the time slows down the closer you get to the sun. Such apparent bending of so-called normal space-time is counterintuitive. Analogously, our space-time dwelling, we call the church, enables us to see Christ in strangers and in all of creation. Hospitality, rightly understood, makes us vulnerable to Christ in all the ways he meets us, including the stranger. Such hospitality does not obscure the particularity of the stranger, but rather enhances it. Here, too, is one whom Christ loves, who is Christ in his humanity, vulnerability, hunger, and thirst. Such an odd truth sets us free to practice of hospitality where, by God's grace, our souls do not draw back when love bids us welcome.
So if we could turn our attention up to the front, and if there are representatives who would like to offer either comments or questions to Beth, who I'm sure is more than capable of deciding or calling on those, and I can just sit to the side.
I've got this.
Oh, you got it. Okay.
Responsibilities, places where we have to be in a position of leadership, like authority, decision making, or where you have. So we were thinking about this kind of difficulty. On the one hand, we don't want to say, well, you should go out there and build the kingdom and be God's strong people, and right, we get the, that's good. We don't want to do that.
Right, yeah, right.
But then how do we think about the things that are strengths that we have, that we should, in fact, be using in service to the church, to each other?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think, I was emphasizing vulnerability because I think that's what's, it's so often something we don't want to see as a resource where God's grace comes through to us. But I think, you know, we use our gifts out of that vulnerability that we have. So, and to be in a position of receiving, we have to receive our gifts, right, to really own them as something that we actually have. So there's a sense there, you have to receive them first and say, yes. You know, I mean, that was the power to me of Teresa's story, because it was like, no, I can't even wipe the ground. And, you know, suddenly she sees God wants her company. And then, it opens up all these gifts in her life. That's sort of the way I would.
It occurred to me through the discussion, really at the wrap up, last night, it occurred to me during the talk that we've institutionalized keeping the alien out of our sight. Like, we can eat the food that this guy picked at great danger to his life to get there, maybe not even able to feed himself or his family. We don't even eat it and it goes bad in our refrigerator, but we've institutionally made them apart from us. And similarly, during this talk, I realized how we've institutionally made ourselves vulnerable, that a lot of us come from institutional invulnerability, where we really, how in the world are we able, you know, when peace was something so tangible, maybe we do need to make, you know, the immigrant, you know, it was said last night, that they are in their bodies what we are kind of spiritually. And I just thought, no, we need to make ourselves and our bodies more vulnerable. Like, it's not enough. It needs to be tangible, like the piece from Alexio. We need to stand against that institutionally and somehow in our bodies embody vulnerability in order to break down that.
That's an excellent insight, because I think I don't know if Danny intended it like this, but yeah, we certainly don't want to sort of spiritualize this because we are talking about the body, the flesh. And I think, yeah, I love your point. I mean, one of my concerns there that I mentioned in terms of the brokenness of the church. It's really interesting. I mean, because we so often say, well, let's exchange our gifts that we have, but we don't come from the position of let's talk about our vulnerabilities. How do we need one another? And I think the same can be applied to the immigrants that we push aside.
Follow-up comment or question, asking a little bit what that would look like in a local congregation, and does that mean, does your question, does some of what you said, imply that the local congregation needs, let's say, undocumented immigrants in its congregation, in its midst, or the other, however defined in your particular context, but particularly people who are extremely vulnerable citizens. For the discipleship of the church itself.
Well, yeah, I think it would be a little difficult for some of us to try to say, well, we got to go out and get it and document it. it might be easier, but I think just to me, it makes more sense to broaden what you said, and in terms of the people who are so obviously. The vulnerable, even though we all are, the mental handicap. I mean, we had a mentally handicapped young woman in our congregation in South Bend for 12 years, and she often did weird things. She was an absolute delight to the group, to the congregation. So I think certainly hospitality is being open to those folks because they call on us to practice our own vulnerability more fully. So that's
probably. No, if I, to make ourselves vulnerable bodily, like how can we do that if we don't use their same transportation, if we don't shop at the same places? I mean, literally, it can start with something just like that. Like just saying, the way that I'm living my life is this way that, this protection, this vulnerability, I never shop at the same place that these people shop. I have a car, so I'm not going to use the bus, or I'm not going to, it's that institutional vulnerability. I can really rely on myself. But if you put yourself in a position where you need as well as they need, I think maybe there's got to be some way to become proximal, to get close to them. We can't just go out and grab a token and drag them into our congregations. But maybe we've made ourselves too invulnerable if we can't even use the same transportation that they use or be in the same places.
We do. And I think sometimes we can be paralyzed by not saying, oh, well, this is just such a large thing. What can we do? But I really liked your comment because I think we can imagine small steps in places where we are, where we can move forward. We don't have to go do the huge thing.
So it may not include going to the Eucharist, but it could include simply being present in the room. And likewise, there's other places in our community that just offers us an opportunity to simply go and see what happens. I mean, we're talking about mystery this morning. Who knows what the outcome of that might be?
There might be analogies here to more directly to immigration, but one of the most powerful things I did, and I think some of you have done in this room as well, was at the last baccalaureate mass when I was leaving St. Anna's College. I was told I could go and get a blessing, and I just happened to put in a line where the bishop was there, and I was sort of embarrassed because everything sort of stopped. You know, I felt like, at least I felt like it. But, you know, he gave me this beautiful blessing, and I've written about this, but to me, it was this exchange of hospitality because I was there witnessing to the brokenness of the church, and he was giving me a blessing. I mean, so there might be places like that that we can carry that in other, where we are present even in our brokenness, where there can be an exchange that takes place.
If you could please stand up. We have time for one more, I think.
Well, one of the things that we were talking about in our group is the importance of listening. And I think in our congregation, the emphasis has been on doing and doing on our own terms services for people, providing sort of a hospitable thing. But what we really seem to need to do is just to be entertained through the listening, through the attending of the Catholic Mass, of a Spanish Mass, through the attending of a secular community event that's about something that's related to the common good, and to be a witness to the church, and that the church says this is good, and just to be listening without falling the temptation necessarily of speaking, which I think is really hard.
Yeah.
But that seems to be a way in which we can receive the sort of experience that we're all talking about, the vulnerability.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. In Bonhoeffer's book, some of you have noted that he has a wonderful section on listening, and it's a listening that comes out of worship and listening to God, a deep sort of silence. So it's this very rich listening, and not just, you know, like a lot of, yeah, when are they going to be done?
Final comment or question?
Yeah, Pat, something I would argue is that when the stranger comes to us in vulnerability, that stranger threatens so much that we try to hide about our own identities, above all, that we too are vulnerable, always have been, always will be. We always were and always will be dependent on others, and that suffering is necessarily, and in many ways, gracefully woven into the fabric of our lives. It's a truth the church teaches, the church also tries to hide from, because we have this other powerful story surrounding us, the myth of autonomy, the myth of independence, self-made woman, self-made man, I can take care of this. So I think that leaves so heavily into the fear, whether it's someone with an intellectual disability, someone with a cognitive decline, or the immigrant, I made it myself, they should make it themselves, et cetera, that we don't want to face the sacred truth about our own being, that autonomy is a lie, that lives measured by productivity and consumption are a lie.